If I understood well, was what was explained by another person before, it was about the land value capture.
Yes.
And we were talked about it during the visit we did just before, and we were told that this instrument at the seems very attractive, but seems to have a default that it rises the price of land, and it tends to make even more difficult the development, for instance, of social housing or maybe of a project bringing less money, since developers integrate this land they use capture
in their process. Right. So let's deal with this. And I was calling this developer contributions, but it is a form of land value capture. We've been looking at other ways of doing land value capture, and I'll give you a bit on that in a moment. Developer contributions, the thing I later called the mayoral community infrastructure levy, are a way of taking some of the change in land value caused by the ability to build on that land from the landowner. But there is only, in a sense, a limited amount, and there are two big ways that we take it out in the UK. One of those is affordable housing. So if you build in London, the mayor would like half of the houses you build to be affordable and only half of them to be market. Now the current, in most boroughs, the actual level is sort of about 30%. The current mayor would like to increase that. And I think this is the question. And you are right, at some level there is a trade-off between, do you take money out for transport, do you take money out for affordable housing? So if you look at that Battersea example that I gave you, the level of affordable housing on the Battersea development was only 15%. But then it was providing almost all the money for a new tube station. So there is a difficult and political trade-off that needs to be mapped. I think you shouldn't just see land value capture as being about new development. Our evidence is that if you take a scheme, say like our Crossrail 2 scheme, that about 25%, a bit less, of the land value change will be about new development. But that Crossrail 2 map showed a route that went across a lot of existing developed suburbs. The evidence of previous projects is that a scheme like that will put up the value of buildings near it by about an additional 15%. So if I go back to that house in Tooting, where there would be a Crossrail 2 stop, going up from 100,000 to 1 million, we are saying that our scheme would add about another 150,000 to the value of that property. That value change on existing property is effectively untaxed under English law, unless you die, broadly. And consequently, is a really interesting question as to whether there is a politically acceptable way of asking people on a transport corridor to make some kind of contribution. And that is an area that we don't have a solution to, but is actually about 65% of the total. So 65% of the total existing residential, about 20% new, and about 15% existing commercial. So we've been operating on the smaller percentages whilst not addressing the big percentage.
So same way.
Yes.
Do you have any problems with environmental organization about this project?
No. Okay. Let's deal with the carbon question first and the environmental one, and then we'll come back and think about the economic change. Clearly, all projects go through an environmental assessment. Yeah? In general, in London, there is still some ability to get journeys transferring, you know, from a road mode to a rail mode, but it's a bit limited. So I wouldn't say that rail projects in London are enormously, you know, produce environmental gain, but they are reasonably environmentally neutral. And in general, economic growth in London, where people don't use cars, is probably more beneficial than economic growth elsewhere. But as I say that, I think Brexit. Yeah? So, yes, there was some environmental opposition. There was some opposition as to what buildings would look like, the local disruption during construction, but it wasn't enormous. Yeah? Right. The economic assessment. We use, as I suspect you do, a conventional benefit-cost ratio system to start with. And that conventional benefit-cost system looks at the people that are travelling, it looks at the time savings, it looks at the costs of construction, it looks a bit at decongestion. When we were doing Crossrail 1, we started to add to that a range of things called wider economic benefits, primarily to do with agglomeration. And the idea here is that if you could create jobs in central London, that those jobs would be more productive than jobs almost anywhere else created in the world. And that because of that, there would be very significant economic value for that. It's all to do with the density of employment and being able to, by additional infrastructure, sustain a more dense employment base. So that wider economic benefit argument was used. It means that you probably go from about a 2, 2.5 to 1 on standard economic benefits for Crossrail 1 to something like a 4 to 1. Now, will those economic benefits appear? That's going to be a very interesting test, yeah? But the argument for Crossrail 1 was around the fact that there would be a significant economic benefit from employment in central London.
I have a question regarding the pricing. How will the pricing evaluate during the year of the financing of the infrastructure?
Okay, so this is a question I'm going to say a Crossrail 1 question for the moment. Well, the position we've got is that we will charge for Crossrail 1 what we are charging for everything else. So there won't be a premium pricing for it, yeah? There may be an element of a slightly higher charge to go to the airport, but then there is a slightly higher charge on the train that it would be replacing. Nothing like the scale of the cost of using the Heathrow Express. So the idea is to integrate Crossrail into our existing pricing structure. How will that pricing structure change? Well, I've just explained that the mayor has had a fare freeze for 4 years, though the current forecast for the next 4 years is that we will go back to having inflation-based increases. We're seeking to, we think, manage our fares as a whole and not to exploit particular lines. Yeah?
Bonjour, juste une question. Est-ce que vous allez surdimensionner les infrastructures pour absorber les pics de trafic dans le futur ou pas du tout dès le démarrage du projet?
So in general, we try and construct the new project so that they will have sufficient capacity to meet a future peak demand. So it's a little bit difficult with a Crossrail. We think Crossrail will be pretty full once it opens. And clearly building extra space underground is enormously expensive. But we have given ourselves some capacity to lengthen Crossrail trains in future, and we will also have some capacity to install remodeled signalling systems that should also increase the ability to get trains through the system. We're starting off at what we think is quite a high level of service, and we will clearly have to observe what happens. An answer almost to some of the previous question is that one of the interesting things about Crossrail is going to be not whether the Crossrail line is full, but whether the existing lines that it parallels and decongests remain full. You know, classic sort of economic analysis says if you abstract traffic from a slow line to put it because people choose to go on a fast line, then that traffic will only, as it were, that abstraction will erode a bit over time, but it won't disappear. We suspect that there is, as it were, if you increase the capacity of our tube network, that there are people who currently don't travel on it in peak hours because it's too full. So there is a kind of suppressed demand. And if that suppressed demand emerges and says, right, now we can get a seat on the central line, now the Jubilee line from London Bridge and Waterloo to Canary Wharf in the morning is just about manageable, we will make those journeys. And that, I think, is almost the more sophisticated test on which we've based some of our revenue analysis. And it's different from what you might do in other cities.
Bonjour, j'avais une question sur le lien avec la place de la voiture au centre de Londres. On sait qu'il y a un péage urbain pour accéder, puisqu'on est véhiculé dans le cœur de ville. Et donc vous, est-ce que lorsque vous pensez les projets de transport en commun, est-ce que vous, ça se fait aussi à l'image, à l'aune du fait d'une volonté politique affichée de limiter la voiture en cœur de ville, ou c'est vraiment deux choses complètement dépendantes?
I think this question of to what extent can we suppress or reduce the amount of usage of cars in central London and the linkage with public transport is quite interesting. London is very much, particularly for employment, a public transport city. I'll give you an anecdote first. I used to travel on the same tube as the big, the senior partner of KPMG, because I'm sure he would have had a car available to him if he wanted, but it was actually quicker to go by tube. And you see that as well in central London, that parking is very restricted and really quite a wide sort of socioeconomic range. One uses the tube and, you know, other forms of public transport. So there isn't a huge amount of modal shift that you can get. There is a bit. Having said that, I agree with you that the answer to reducing car usage is also to be seen to be doing something about public transport. So if you look at the congestion charge, it was felt that we should be improving the bus service and investing in renewing the existing underground as well. So those are important things, and I think they are important as we move to more road user charging, to ULEZ, yeah? But it wasn't a big driver on the Crossrail 1 project.
Vous avez déjà une idée du budget, des financements. Imaginons qu'une fois que vous lancez les travaux sur le deuxième volet, ça coûte plus cher. Est-ce que parmi les financeurs, il y a déjà cette hypothèse qui est envisagée ou non?
Well, what we were, where we were with the government, and there's a report that we wrote with them a year ago, it's not yet been published, was that they were saying, can you get to 50% and can you also take on your 50% as debt during construction? So many of the things that we had available, I find my way back to the Crossrail 2 slide, many of the things that we had available wouldn't be available until the thing was open. You only get the operating surplus, the profits from the exploitation, after it's opened. You only can resell the land and property after it's opened. So we had two issues with the government, which was first, there was probably we weren't offering quite enough money, and secondly, we were worried about having to borrow a lot of money during the construction period. And a solution to Crossrail 2 will probably have to address both of those questions, and I think it may also have to look at how we can build a railway through London's richer suburbs and ask people to make a contribution to that, which is the land value capture point we were speaking on earlier. I'm sorry I'm giving you answers in English.
Hello.
Thank you to listen in French. Question.
Oui. Est-ce que vous pourriez nous préciser un petit peu le statut juridique après des infrastructures et le lien avec l'exploitation et notamment également au niveau de vous évoquiez l'interopérabilité des tarifs avec le fer. Donc il y a le réseau ferroviaire, le réseau métro. Donc, in fine, les infrastructures, à qui elles appartiennent et quel lien avec l'exploitation?
So, you asked me a sort of a legal question about what was the basis, yeah, for having a shared tariff structure. And there was a bit, I think, at the beginning for the general legal basis for building infrastructure as well. Yeah? So, it's interesting because the basis of it started before TFL. So the basis of the thing started with a paper ticket called the travel card. So the travel card said that London was going to be in a set of zones and that if you caught either a train or a tube service, the tariff you pay would be determined by the zones that you went through. So there was a joint ticket structure, yeah? And that joint ticket structure, as I said, predates TFL. Now, what was required with that was that there was a clearinghouse, is the phrase in English, so that a pot of common revenues could be divided between the operators. And I know you have something similar around Paris. Yeah? From that paper ticket, you move first to the Oyster card. So the Oyster card was a proprietary card which said that if you follow the rules of the card and if you tap in and tap out on the tube and the railway, and if you tap every time you go into a bus, the computer will work out at the end of the day what's the cheapest ticket you could have bought. So it works it out afterwards. And Oyster was very interesting because initially the railway companies, so obviously TfL controls Tube and Bus, the railway companies said, we're not interested, we don't want to be part of this. The national government said, well, this is a London thing, it's not anything to do with us. And then they began to realise, one, that it was extremely popular, and secondly, that actually if you make it easy to pay fares, people will travel more often, because they won't worry about what sort of ticket do I have to get. They just go tap, and they know after the first few journeys they'll get the cheapest ticket, and they don't have to work out, well, if I make two metro journeys and three bus journeys, is it better to buy a day pass, or I might go to tomorrow as well? All of those questions were taken away. And because it generated more revenue, people were actually saying, well, actually, we'd like to join in. And so that's how it expanded. And gradually, central government started telling the railway companies, actually, we want people to be able to use the Oyster system as far out as Gatwick, which is the airport, significantly outside London. And from Oyster, we then said, well, why should we have a system whereby people have to change their money into TfL money and put it on a card? Why can't we just let them tap a bank card and then that's their Oyster card, and as long as they use the same one, yeah, then it'll work in exactly the same way. And that again has been significantly successful at bringing in new revenue and lowering the costs for us of providing the system. What's the judicial basis of that, you're going to ask me, so you'll feel I haven't done. Well, broadly, it's a set of contractual agreements between the operators, but with the mayor and central government, as it were, enforcing, yeah? And with the fact that it's an economic success, binding people into it.
There was another question about who owns the infrastructure.
Yeah. So, TfL owns the tube, yeah? It directly operates the tube, so we employ the tube drivers. TfL owns the infrastructure for most of, I'm going to call them the secondary rail things. What do I mean? The Docklands Light Railway, a tram system in Croydon, we own the infrastructure, yeah? We contract out the operation as we contract out buses. We don't own the national rail infrastructure, but we do operate some services on national rail infrastructure. And we've tried to get away from these questions of ownership to getting something that works for the passenger. I don't know if anyone here's been on what we call the overground, but the orange line. It comes quite close to this bit of London. Okay, that is a combination of an old underground line, which we own, and a series of suburban railway lines, which we don't own, and a single train running on both. Very successful for the passengers. It's a bit of a mess in infrastructure terms, but what we're trying to do is to make it customer-focused.
Oui. J'étais surpris de voir que, alors que TfL gère pratiquement tout le spectre des infrastructures de transport terrestre, vous ayez laissé les parkings de côté. Est-ce que ça fait partie d'un deal original, enfin d'une ligne rouge qui a été tracée en disant non, on ne se met pas des parkings parce que c'est une chasse gardée privée, ou est-ce qu'aujourd'hui vous ne considérez pas que c'est une forme de manque à gagner, ou de manque de levier stratégique aussi pour l'intermodalité avec le développement des parkings relais ou des choses comme ça?
You understand?
Mostly about on-street parking.
The question is, you're managing all the land transportation,
yeah.
But you're not dealing the park, the car
okay.
park.
Yeah. So we don't deal with car parks,
yeah,
or car parking generally. Let's go back and have a look at the roads. TfL is the owner of London's main roads. So it does own the Euston Road, which is near here by King's Cross Station, and the whole of what's called the inner sort of circular road, and a number of the other bigger roads going out. But for instance, we don't own Oxford Street. Yeah, that is a local road which is run by the borough, Westminster City Council. Yeah, and in general, it's the boroughs that operate the parking. And they run a range of schemes, most of central and inner London. There are schemes that reserve parking for residents and charge other users of that parking, but the rules are set locally, they're not set centrally. Can we manage London's transport without controlling the parking in central London? Yeah? I think we probably can, and I point at the congestion charge and ULEZ as ways that we do that. Yeah, we also, through our, the mayor sets strategic planning policy in London. The particular permits to construct buildings or whatever are done by the boroughs, but according to a London plan set by the mayor, and I'm sure other people have talked to you about this, that London plan has got very restrictive rules about what parking is permitted in new developments. So that's an example of us influencing something without controlling it. Yeah?
But a source of revenue of income for financing public transportation.
I'd love to get the source of income.
So why don't you go into
the
business?
Because someone else gets that income. So the boroughs get it, yeah, and it's very significant for the central London boroughs, and they are supposed to spend it on improving the roads, yeah. But the income from parking in Westminster is, I think, significantly larger than the property tax on residents. Yeah? But if you try, in the public sector, if you try and take other organisations' money, it tends to lead to difficulties. Yeah?
I hope I can ask a question. I'm an interloper here. I was the previous speaker earlier in the afternoon. I'm a Londoner from UCL. Lots of questions I'd like to ask, but the most important one, I think, is about this land value capture problem. From your perspective, the challenge is how do we get contribution into the transport investment programme. A related consideration is how we organise property tax on homes and businesses, which in Britain works very badly. Residential property tax is very low but also very regressive. I'd really like to hear your comments on whether you think eventually we can move towards a serious property tax, progressive property tax system which achieves your objectives, and or a land value tax which might do the same thing.
I think this is, if I'd say, it's a really good and core question. A lot of the land value capture ideas are, I think, sort of second best to having an underlying workable property tax. But this is one of the things where it's very, very difficult to find a politician who is prepared to advocate the changes in council tax that would be required. I'm just going to sort of internationalise that a bit. We haven't revalued domestic property in London since 1990. So when they build new skyscrapers along the Thames, someone goes round and says, what was this worth in 1990? And the fact of this system means that the changes that have made inner London wealthier, relatively, and outer London poorer, relatively, are not picked up in the tax base. And the tax levels are also very small. So a typical property in Westminster will pay no more than about £1,300 a year, something like that, same in where I live in Wandsworth. And yet that property could be worth £1 million, £2 million. So it's a very difficult system. Problem. Just before it was introduced, when we had the last reform of local government taxation, which was 89 with Mrs. Thatcher's poll tax, it produced rioting in suburban Britain, which is pretty rare. And the politicians took a view from this of, never again, I'm not going to go near this problem. And that's why I think we're stuck. A lot of empathy with doing it, but I can't see, so you know, the mayoral candidates are not coming out making those sorts of remarks. Sorry.
The value could be captured when the property is going from one owner to
yes.
another.
And that's what we think we'd like
for
to try and do.
When you sold your house.
Yes, exactly. And we think that you could do things like either revalue for taxation purposes when there is a sale, or you could have a kind of supplement in the corridor that people could either pay on an annual basis or could be rolled up and dealt with when there's a transaction. Very sensible. The only difficulty with that is partly because of our very low annual tax, the transaction tax on property in the UK is relatively high and has been concentrated on London. So, something as you journey further north, two London boroughs, Westminster and Kensington, pay as much property transaction tax as the, I think it is the whole of England and Wales, down to about Birmingham. Yeah? So, again, it's a very relatively high tax in London, and it starts to have effects. The sorts of effects that people say it has is, rather than move house, people will dig out their basement. They're very rich, they can afford it. And consequently, you may be seeing changes in the city, yeah, that are possibly not economically sensible and maybe disruptive, being caused by the tax system. So I'm just a little bit... I think the transaction idea is probably the right one, but we have to approach it in a cautious way.
Where is the microphone? Ah, voilà, on fait des coups là.
Oui, merci. J'aurais voulu revenir très brièvement sur... la dette de financement par l'emprunt qui représente une petite part, enfin environ 30% si j'ai bien compris, de Crosswell 1. Je voulais savoir, une structure comme TFL, était-elle contrainte par un certain nombre de règles relatives à l'endettement, ou est-ce que vous avez une très grande marge de manœuvre en matière d'endettement? Je voulais savoir sur quelle durée vous empruntiez, puisque cet empruntement, j'imagine, est adossé aux recettes tarifaires à venir, hein, a priori. Sur quelle durée vous empruntez? Qui est propriétaire de... Est-ce qu'aujourd'hui, vous avez... Votre dette est britannique, si je puis dire. Est-ce qu'elle est contractée auprès d'institutions qui sont principalement des institutions britanniques? Et puis, dernière question, est-ce que par rapport à la gestion de cet endettement, vous identifiez de votre côté un risque particulier lié au Brexit? Merci.
Wow. The Brexit question. Right, so What I was picking from that is these are questions about TfL's debts, how is it controlled, where is the money from, is that primarily, I'm going to call it domestic borrowing, and are there some Brexit-related issues? So I'm going to give you a sort of legal-ish answer to start with, which is that TfL is treated as a municipality, as a local authority. So its debt forms part of the UK public sector and is treated as part of the UK public sector total. Now, in technical terms, the debt is not guaranteed by the UK state. But, unlike in America, the UK government has never let a UK municipal body fail. It's always, in the end, bailed them out. So you might say there is a kind of, a sort of guarantee, even if there isn't a strict legal one. Now, what comes with that, because of the scale of the borrowing we do, is that there is a direct, I'm going to call it fiscal, because it's dealing with tax and spending at a national level, control from the Ministry of Finance, from the Treasury. So they say, in this year, you can borrow £700 million. Ah, you've got a problem with your project, you may borrow a further £1 billion on an exceptional basis. Those are the sorts of decisions that we see. Yeah? So it is something that is negotiated between the mayor as our political leader and the Minister of Finance, the Chancellor of the Exchequer. We are getting a bit more cautious. When our debts were £2 billion, I think it was pretty clear we could borrow more. Now they are £12 billion, we are a bit more cautious. But it's a major part of our investment spend. Where do we borrow the money from? We have three sources for borrowing money, and at present they are about equal. And we will go to the one that we think is cheapest. The three sources that we have are effectively the state. It's a body called the Public Works Loan Board, but it is the state lending to municipal organisations. And that is at the cost of the national debt, what I would call the gilt cost, plus 0.8% as a margin. So there is a margin applied. The second thing we have done in the past is that we have borrowed significantly on what I would call the capital market. So we have issued bonds. And those bonds are in our own name, and we have our own program for those. And then the third thing is, in the past, the European Investment Bank has been a major, yeah, has been a major lender to TfL, and they have offered us very good terms over long term. You asked me what's the term, you know, the maturity of our debt. And it's mostly 25 to 30 years, so we are not exposed to short-term shocks, and that relates to the very long-term nature of our infrastructures as well. Will we miss the European Investment Bank if there is no longer UK access to it, and this is all in those Brexit clouds? I think we probably will. There is no plan to have a British investment bank to replace it, and it has been cheaper and offered these longer term loans than we could get from other sources. But all of those loans count against a public expenditure control limit. So it's a sort of secondary question, who do you borrow from? The primary question is, how much are you prepared to borrow?
Joke question, what could be a foreign debt for a global city?
A very good question. And particularly one like London, which has got access to very substantial market liquidity.
I imagine that.
Est-ce qu'il y a beaucoup de débats autour du rôle structurant joué par les transports dans le développement économique? C'est une question qui est beaucoup traitée en France, avec l'idée qu'il y a un mythe autour de ce lien direct entre investissement dans les infrastructures de transport et développement.
So, a links between transport investment and development.
There is a discussion about the reality. The reality of this link, is it as strong as it is supposed?
Is there any debate about the role played by infrastructures?
I think this is really interesting because it happens over a long period of time, a point I made earlier, that you have to choose to make an investment and you only see the effects later. I think we would say in London that the link appears to be really quite strong for us. Now that link is because we've got visible congestion on the existing network, because we've clearly been, something has been making London and particularly inner London develop very substantially over those last 30 years. And we think that one of the constraints on that development that remains is transport. Another one coming up is housing, but transport we pretty well accept is there. Now, I think that puts us in a different situation, that if you are somewhere else and you are trying to build, say, your first light rail line in Edinburgh or in a provincial city somewhere in Europe, it's a more difficult question because you're moving from having buses to having a rail-based system for the first time. But even that huge Crossrail 1 project is only adding 10% to our capacity at a point when demand 10 years ago was growing by about 4 to 5% a year. Yeah? So for us, I think we think the links are quite strong. The caution in my voice comes back to, will London continue to grow? And will there be some kind of social change so that people no longer travel to work in the same way?
I take perhaps the privilege to ask you the last questions. The first very quick one. I didn't understand really the timing, the calendar of Crossrail 1. From the first moment you decided the infrastructure to next year.
Okay, so if I talk through the timeline on Crossrail 1, I can do that.
One important thing that Heathrow will be linked to the central of London in a much more efficient way, if I understood well. We have debates about privatization of our airports in France now. Heathrow is a private company. It's owned by a private company. What kind of contribution did it bring to have this
Heathrow contribution?
And something I didn't quite understand that I think important. You are a local authority. And we were told today that for a while local government didn't have the right to borrow.
Yes, correct.
So maybe you can clarify this point. And my very last question. You began telling us that it was fascinating period to talk about this subject.
Yeah.
And maybe you could end your speech precising exactly why you had this in mind. Okay.
Let's try with some of the simpler bits of that first. The deal, and I'll see if I can have a reference to it in these papers. Yeah. BAA is Heathrow. It used to stand for British Airport Authority, and then they removed the words and were just left with the letters. And they promised a contribution of several hundred million. We said to the government, look, we don't control the airport. In a sense, if anybody does, you do. So you can take the risk on that, and you can collect that contribution. And my understanding is the airport managed to duck and dive out of about half of it, but did make a contribution to the scheme. Yeah? Now, I've got the Crossrail timeline, and I've got why this is interesting times.
And the borrowing.
And the borrowing. So let's talk about municipal borrowing. Very simply, go back 20, 30 years, you have Mrs. Thatcher as Prime Minister. You have a considerable effort to centralise control over local government. She abolishes the Greater London Council, headed by Ken Livingstone, who later reappears as mayor. That's politics for you. And her view was that most local government wasn't fit to borrow money because they would just abuse it. And consequently, there were quite extensive controls on what local government could borrow. Back at about the year 2000, you've got the Tony Blair government, and they come up with a view that local government should be allowed to borrow, provided they do so prudently. And prudential borrowing becomes the phrase, and it has to be against clearly identified income level. But with the exception of TfL, that borrowing is not regulated by the state. It's regulated in a sense by the professional rules of the accountancy bodies and by the professionalism of the managers. One local authority, which is TfL, is positively given a limit, yeah, for the reasons that I explained earlier. So that combination of two things, a new TfL being created in the year 2000 with no debt, and the ability, subject to the control, to borrow money, are the reasons why you've seen a investment programme, with a lot of which has been financed by long-term borrowing. So you can see that story, and if I'd had time, I'd have talked to you about the way that we've replaced a lot of public-private partnerships, yeah, with, as it were, our own debt. And that's been something that you'll have seen over the last sort of 15 years. Yeah? Shall I go on and talk about the Crossrail timetable? Crossrail was first thought about, see if I can get the map up of this one, during the Second World War. Because people started to say, wouldn't it be a good idea to have a railway line that linked Paddington and potentially Liverpool Street? And wouldn't it be a good idea to be able to run trains through the centre of London? By the time you get to the late 1980s, there were a series of studies, and I was involved at the margins of these as a young official, looking at options within central London for different routes, north-south, east-west, there was one actually that would have done a kind of combination of the two and started here and then gone from Waterloo to Liverpool Street. And out of that, nothing much happened because there wasn't the institutional structure to do it, and the dominant theme at the time was actually to privatise the national railway. But in its sort of last years, the British Railways Board brought forward a proposal for a Crossrail, and it looks not that much different from what is up there. There are some changes. And that proposal failed in the House of Commons and was then effectively cancelled in about the mid-1990s. And with the change of government, with a new Mayor of London, in about 2002, and I was a consultant then and again involved at the margin, people began to think again about what had happened to the Crossrail project and is this something that could now be delivered, and as I showed you, with a different sort of funding structure and a different sort of institutional basis. And I should remember 2002 because, to everybody's surprise, there was a whole office block of people who'd been working on this council project for 5 years, who sort of emerged through the cobwebs as the project was revived. That cancellation now looks, as I said, a bad thing. The new scheme did do more out in the Docklands, area of great growth. We've not spoken much about it, but I'm sure other people have talked to you about it. And that takes us forward, construction starting in about 2009, and it takes us forward to us getting a bit of a delay, a year's delay at the end. Unfortunate, but compared to a number of other projects, not, in my view, disastrous. And I hope we will be there with an open project quite soon. You can, if you're lucky, actually go down and see all the stations, and they look pretty finished. Yeah, and last time I was in one, I saw a train run through. But anything to do with railway signalling has to be an absolutely 100% safe. And Crossrail, you see, deals with one signalling system here, one signalling system here, and another signalling system out there. So it's got real, real IT difficulties sorting all of that out. Okay, how do we pull all of this into your visit, into this sort of Brexit week, into issues of London and the provinces? Well, I think what I've been talking to you about is a fairly unplanned and then very strong growth of the capital city over a 25-year period. And in that period, you can measure it in a number of ways, but London grew significantly richer and faster than much of the rest of, certainly, England. Indeed, probably most of the other regions of the UK. And you saw a services economy emerge in a dominant way, with a lot of immigration coming into it, yeah, and other parts of England feeling that they were, I'm going to say, left behind. And you then get, quite well put, there's a man called David Goodhart who wrote a book called Somewhere and Anywhere. But it's a book that says there's this difference between people who, broadly, live in the same area that they were born in, don't move around very much, and people who have moved, say, to London, yeah, and who might be prepared to live in a range of other places in the world. And that somewhere and anywhere, that capital city versus the provinces, and indeed to some extent cities versus towns and the countryside, is the electoral divide that you see in the Brexit vote of 3 years ago. And I've always said that there are sort of two visions of Brexit, and I don't know where we will end up. One was a kind of, let's go back to the past, things have gone downhill in the, you know, recently, and we'd like to go back to a sort of a Britain of the 1950s or something like that. And the other was one saying, let's go global, let's drop levels of regulation and protection, and let's go and propel the economy forwards in a very free market direction. They're actually, I think, quite contradictory, and I've never known which one would emerge. I think the let's go back to a more equal past is almost certainly bad for London. I think the global city one would be challenging, but could be very interesting for London. If we finally look at this population trend here, and you start to say why, yeah, that again just gives you some reasons as to what was happening then, what happened afterwards, why there might be a reaction to it. London was dispersed during the Second World War, partly for national security reasons, partly it was seen almost as a matter of public health, that a dispersed population would be a healthier population. And equally at the same time, if you dispersed industry across the country, that would help things be more equal, would avoid the fact that in the 1930s, you'd have this exponential growth of London out into its metro land, where some of the older cities and the older industries had been very badly hit. So you go into a period of dispersal and constraint and regional subsidy, regional policy, and as well, quite often, government policies that were tilted towards manufacturing industry and away from services industry, and there was selective taxation in part of the 60s. So I suspect that part of these changes are to do with the breakup of the financial monopolies and oligopolies in the city, Mrs. Thatcher and a more free market approach, and the fact that London proved to be very adaptable to those in a way that other parts of the country were not. Now, those are sort of personal views. You get different views from other people. It's a huge subject of debate, but that's how I would end it up. And I think one of the questions as we go forward is London going to be allowed to continue to grow? Is that a good thing for the UK? What's going to happen in the other cities? Again, just sort of go back for a moment. London, in those years 2000, was producing the tax revenues that the Blair and Brown governments spent elsewhere. When you hit an economic bump with the economic crisis of the late, 2000s, those tax revenues disappear. London survives, but the money that could be spent in the rest of the UK falls significantly, and that austerity also leads to some of the social effects that we've discussed earlier. So really interesting things, I think, for you to think about during the rest of your visit.
Thank you.